You want something to do this weekend? How about a championship football game? How about an arts festival? How about some basketball games? How about all of that and more in one city?
We will be offering some additional train trips or trains in between the 15-minute schedules just to accommodate the higher ridership that we anticipate.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, Tempe braces for a busy weekend. Child welfare advocates this week offered suggestions on ways to improve Arizona's CPS. Are other states doing any better?
Gas prices are close to $3 a gallon in Arizona. What's with the ups and downs?
A smart retailer is going to raise the price as soon as he sniffs that the wholesale cost is going up. But I'm not going to lower my price until I see others lowering their price.
Plus, opinions on wolves. A new art project aims to keep people warm, and Arizona gets a new war memorial.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The U.S. unemployment rate is at a five-year low, with employers adding 203,000 jobs last month. The Labor Department says that helped lower the unemployment rate from 7.3% in October. White House Council of Economic Advisers Chairman Jason Furman says even though the jobless rate is coming down, there's still plenty of work to do.
The decline in unemployment we saw was all from the short-term unemployed getting jobs. If you look at people who have been out of work for 27 weeks or longer, that actually ticked up slightly.
The Labor Department says manufacturing added 27,000 jobs, construction added 17,000. President Obama and the First Lady will visit South Africa next week. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports they'll participate in memorials for Nelson Mandela, along with many other world leaders.
Flags are flying at half staff over the White House and across the country. For President Obama, Nelson Mandela had personal significance. At the White House Thursday night, Obama said his first political experience was campaigning against apartheid as a college student.
I would study his words and his writings. The day he was released from prison gave me a sense of what human beings can do when they're guided by their hopes and not by their fears.
Events honoring Mandela are planned across Johannesburg over the next week. The official memorial service will take place at a stadium next Tuesday. Mandela will then lie in state. He'll be buried Sunday, December 15th. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
Less than a week since its deadly train derailment in New York City, Metro North Railway is facing mandatory changes. NPR's Dan Bobkoff says the ruling comes from the Federal Railway Administration.
The FRA calls it an emergency order requiring Metro North to change its signal system so that train engineers follow speed limits. The commuter railroad also must send the FRA a list of locations where speed limits drop quickly on its lines. And Metro North will be required to improve its early warning technology. And starting now, its trains must have two operators manning the controls whenever a speed limit changes at least 20 miles per hour. The mandatory ruling comes after a Metro North commuter train derailed Sunday morning in the Bronx as it rounded a sharp turn at 82 miles per hour, nearly three times the posted speed limit. The investigation into the crash continues. Dan Bobkoff, NPR News, New York.
Winter storm warnings have been issued in at least eight states in the Midwest and South, including Texas, Oklahoma, Indiana, and Arkansas. Courtney Collins from member station KERA says the Dallas-Fort Worth area is already hard hit.
A lot of the times we brace for storms that don't really come. A few weeks ago, that was the case. But this is the real deal.
The National Weather Service says parts of Minnesota have already gotten up to 2 feet of snow. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Chilly temperatures still with us around the valley. Looking for lows tonight in the lower to mid-30s, depending on where you are in the valley. Currently, it's sunny and 54 degrees. If you're on the freeways, one accident to watch out for, I-10 westbound at Avondale Boulevard.
In the news this hour, a French judge has allowed the sale of several sacred Hopi artifacts to go ahead next week. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
The Hopi tribe's lawyer used a French law to argue that it's illegal to sell masks as commercial art because they're like tombs containing their ancestors' spirits. The masks are so sacred that the tribe doesn't want them discussed or seen, let alone sold. The Hopi call them friends and put them on to pray for rain and harmony. This is the second time the tribe has taken a Paris auction house to court over the issue, and it's the second time the tribe has lost. In April, a judge ruled that such sales are legal, so an auction house sold about 70 ceremonial items for more than $1 million, despite objections from the U.S. government. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
A Superior Court judge in Phoenix is considering a request to revive a lawsuit that asks a judge to rule Arizona's campaign contribution limits are unconstitutionally low. The suit filed by Kathleen Wynne was dismissed in October by Judge Sally Duncan, but she's hearing a renewed bid by Wynne this afternoon. Wynne is an aide to Attorney General Tom Horn. She and Horn have been accused by the Yavapai County attorney of illegally coordinating campaign spending in his 2010 election while she ran an independent committee. They deny those allegations. Wynne is seeking to sidetrack that case by having the contribution limits nullified. The suit was dismissed because no case was pending and Wynne had not exhausted other legal remedies. Wynne is arguing the new Yavapai County allegations merit reviving her case.
Two college basketball games, an arts festival, and a Pac-12 championship football game all in one town on the same day. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to flood the area around Tempe's Mill Avenue tomorrow. And as KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez reports, the city is bracing itself.
Tempe officials expect 300,000 people to squeeze into the downtown area Saturday, an unusual amount for this time of year. The Mill Avenue district usually attracts a much smaller crowd for its annual weekend arts festival in December, but you may have heard the Pac-12 college football championship will be played here Saturday night. The number of visitors will skyrocket.
We normally have a great day on a football game and a fabulous weekend for the art festival, and putting them both together, it is a logistical nightmare.
Nancy Horman is the executive director of the Downtown Tempe Community, a nonprofit group that works to promote the area.
But something that we live for, so it's really something that we think we can handle.
Horman says the district has hosted multiple events on one day before, but this time it's different. It is the first time ASU has hosted a Pac-12 championship game at Sun Devil Stadium. Several streets, including Mill Avenue, will be closed for the entire weekend, so Horman says the first priority is traffic flow. If you're going to the art festival, she says, get off at Priest.
And if you're coming for the football game, then go to the east side and Hayden Ferry on Rito Salado.
Or you can take the light rail.
Riders can count on catching the train on the typical Saturday schedule every 15 minutes.
Susan Tierney is the Valley Metro spokesperson.
However, we will be offering some additional train trips or trains in between the 15-minute schedules just to accommodate the higher ridership that we anticipate.
Tierney says Valley Metro is using all its light rail cars to support the crowds. Each train will have three cars, transporting at least 600 people at a time.
We will have transit security positioned at the stations in Tempe, as well as additional fare inspectors and security officers on board the trains.
Like all large events held here, police officers will be spread across downtown and around the stadium. Tempe Police spokesperson Mike Pulley says at least 100 extra officers will be brought in to help.
We got DPS that's bringing a lot of manpower, Scottsdale, Mesa, MCSO, and some other agencies that are going to be bringing in different resources. We're going to have additional mounted units or horses out here with officers. We're going to have additional bike officers. Just know that you're in good hands. We want people to come out, have a good time.
Downtown Tempe Community's Executive Director Nancy Horman agrees. She says the city doesn't shy away from events like these.
Having a championship, something we haven't had in forever, is an amazing thing to really perpetuate what is the new energy in downtown Tempe.
According to the Tempe Tourism Office, that energy could generate $8 million over the weekend. Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, KJZZ News, Tempe.
It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Mark, not to give away too much personal information, but you spent Thanksgiving on the East Coast. What was the average high temperature for the days you were there?
I would say probably about 30 most days. Just beautiful, kind of balmy, actually.
Okay, take it easy. I've lived here most of my life. To have high temperatures in the 50s like we have this week is a bit much for me.
Oh, quit whining.
The record high for yesterday's date in the Valley, Mark, was 82 degrees, and that happened just last year. So it's not like we've had to get used to that or something. Today, the National Weather Service in Phoenix issued its winter weather outlook. I went to their office, talked with senior forecaster Mark O'Malley. I first asked him about preparing for the short term, the very short term, this weekend, which will still be cold.
Not that cold.
At least 10 degrees below normal.
It's a little bit cooler than average. Actually, we're not even approaching what will be record lows for the city of Phoenix. A lot of the record lows this time of year are in the lower to middle 20s. So we're only going to be kind of in the upper 20s to lower 30s. Now, that is significant as far as the outskirts of the metro will see freezing temperatures. However, it's not unprecedented.
Does this foreshadow for us something as far as the winter season early 2014 goes? Should we expect colder than normal temperatures?
Not necessarily. The past several Decembers, we've actually been wetter than average across the state. However, that does not say anything about the remainder of the winter. Just because you're cold for a week or two does not necessarily mean that the rest of the winter will be cooler, warmer, or near average.
I'm really curious about where our storms come from, because I've always thought that they either come up from Mexico, or maybe they come around, they're going to come through LA, through San Diego, and then come to us. But this is a Pacific Northwest storm.
It seems this year we're under a predominance of storms that are coming out of the Pacific Northwest, which are cold storms that don't necessarily always produce a lot of precipitation. If we are in an El Nino year, which I think everyone's around here is kind of familiar with, those storms seem to come from the Pacific and across Los Angeles and San Diego, produce a lot more rain for us in general. We're not looking at that type of pattern this year.
So, Mark, if you were to give some people advice, because we're still a couple of weeks ahead of Christmas, mm-hmm. so people haven't bought the gift yet for the friend, the spouse, the family. Yes. They're thinking, should I buy somebody a sweater, heavy jacket for the winter in Phoenix? What do you say?
Go ahead and do it. You're probably not going to get a lot of use out of it in this part of the country, but I'm sure someone would appreciate it for those week or two where you can really put on the heavy jacket and bundle up. That would be appreciated, but I'm sure as the sun rises around here, that come in a couple weeks, we'll be back up into the 60s, touching 70 degrees.
Mark O'Malley, senior forecaster at the National Weather Service Phoenix office. Earlier this week, that blast of cold air brought some snow, precipitation to northern Arizona, and late last month, we had a dusting of snow as well. What's the impact on the snowpack in Arizona? With me now is Dino DeSimone, water supply specialist for the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
It did give us a big boost in our early snowpack. At this moment, we sit at about 211% of our normal snowpack for the first week of December. So that was a big boost right here.
What would we need to happen for us to get ahead and not just maintain the snowpack level?
We always say if we get 2 to 3 above normal winters, we basically can plan to fill up the reservoirs. At this point, our reservoirs are in decent shape inside Arizona. The SRP reservoirs are pretty much at about 100% of what we call the median or normal level. Now, they're far from full as they were in 2010, and so we always hope for another big winter to fill them up.
Dino, finally, what about monitoring stations? Is there enough information being gathered? Because I know there have been some budget cuts.
As far as the automated stations we have up in the mountains in northern and eastern Arizona, we have not reduced any of those. So we actually have 22 automated snowpack measurement sites throughout the mountains, and they're in good shape. We do maintenance every year, and they're all ready to go for this winter. They're sending out the data every hour to our database and being uploaded right away to the website, so people can look during a storm and see how both the overall snow is falling as well as the amount of moisture that we're receiving in the precipitation cans that we have at those sites. We do have some manually measured sites where we send out snow surveyors to measure the depth and the water content of the snow. Some of that's been reduced due to budget cuts.
Dino DeSimone, he is water supply specialist for the state of Arizona.
Still to come, land prices are up and the state is looking to cash in.
For now, we will likely see some more auctions coming up in the next year that achieve some very high returns for the trust.
That story ahead, it's the show.
Don't be fooled by the sun and our bright blue skies. It will be cool today around the valley, looking for a high in the mid-50s. Our normal for today is 67 degrees for this weekend. Partly sunny tomorrow, a slight chance for rain and a high of 56. Partly cloudy Sunday, down to 53 degrees. Currently sunny and 54. Quick check of valley traffic and accident 51 southbound just in at Greenway. HOV lane is blocked.
KJZZ is supported by Barrow Neurological Institute at St. Joseph's, exploring the wonders of the human brain and spine for more than 50 years. Here's to the brain and the neurosurgeons and specialists that care for it. AmazingMedicine.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The strike by fast food workers in cities across the U.S. this week is a small labor dispute. In economic terms, in dollar terms. They're demanding $15 an hour, up from, say, $8 an hour, which is sort of the industry average in the fast food industry, which is a very profitable industry in our country. A small dispute, but it raises a huge issue about the economic inequality of our time. This is something President Barack Obama spoke about this week.
I believe this is the defining challenge of our time, making sure our economy works for every working American.
But the growing inequality in America may be the defining phenomenon of the Obama era. Joining us now is Heather McGee, who's Vice President of Policy and Outreach at the Demos Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Alter, journalist and author of The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about this legacy question. The economic inequality has grown during the Obama era. In some sense, it's been absolutely an inevitable consequence of the recession that began in 2008. How much do you think that is this president's responsibility for not turning around or significantly addressing? Jonathan?
Well, it's happening on his watch, but this problem really goes back 25 years is when the structural changes in the American economy that drove inequality really kicked in. Republican policies have exacerbated this economic inequality. Democratic policies have not done much to mitigate the effects of these changes and soften the structural changes. So the best that President Obama can do is to try to dent the problem with things like the Affordable Care Act, raising the minimum wage, funding pre-K, which helps people get off on the right foot and get into the middle class eventually, and a series of other things that might be a little bit more creative that haven't gotten very much discussion that relate, for instance, to helping the incarcerated reintegrate into society when they get out of prison. But, you know, all of these initiatives are going to be fought right into the teeth of intense Republican opposition, which is the president's political fate.
Heather McGee, what do you think on this legacy question?
I think the president has already done quite a bit more than obviously the last president, who saw basically who governed over a lost decade of progress for most Americans by simply raising this issue. The speech he gave yesterday, I mean, Demos is a progressive think tank that has been talking about more equality in our democracy and in our economy right. for about 15 years now. Our organization basically could have written that speech. It was sort of a progressive dream speech that laid out the generation-wide decline that was really caused not just by globalization and technological change, but an ideological shift to trickle-down economics. So for the president to tell that story and use the bully pulpit was a really historic event.
Although, does a single speech reverse these kind of numbers? Harvard University's Institute of Politics finds that 47% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29, that's core base zone for Barack Obama, would vote to recall the president from office. 57% are unhappy with the Affordable Care Act, and that's the president's real achievement. Poll numbers are mushy. They move around. But right there in the base, to have that level of dissatisfaction— What do you make of that, Heather?
Yeah, I think it's a really great question because this millennial generation, of which I'm sort of at the leading oldest edge of, is really the inequality generation, the generation that has been actually historically the most progressive on issues of how activist the government should be, is really the one that has been slammed hardest by the trickle-down economy. Our generation has been the guinea pigs. We're the ones who are the first generation in American history to not do better than our parents. Of course, we are the ones who actually benefit the most from the Affordable Care Act, whether it's staying on our parents' plans until we're 26 or actually being able to buy insurance through the marketplace. So I think those numbers are really temporary. They're showing a good deal of dissatisfaction with progress in Washington. But this generation is going to be the generation to make inequality the issue of our lifetimes.
Jonathan Alter, at a moment of unsustainability in the Gilded Age, Teddy Roosevelt basically pulled the plug on traditional politics and inaugurated the progressive era and really changed things fundamentally. Would you view the Obama administration right now as a failed attempt at progressivism or basically a kind of maintenance, incremental approach that allowed him to be overwhelmed by events, as you've just described, Jonathan?
Well, I don't think he has been overwhelmed by events for one important reason, and that is the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned Theodore Roosevelt. You know, the idea of universal health insurance, universal coverage, goes back to the Progressive Party platform of 1912 when Theodore Roosevelt ran for president. Seven American presidents tried and failed to do something about this. Barack Obama succeeded. So whatever problems there might be with the website, whatever bumps in the road, this is a major progressive accomplishment. And so as we get kind of bogged down in the fiasco that is healthcare.gov, you know, let's not lose sight of this. This
All right.
is a very big deal.
Jonathan Alter, journalist and author of The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies. Heather McGee, Vice President of Policy and Outreach at Demos. Heather and Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
That was The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
It's been a pretty good week for the state land department. On Tuesday, the agency sold around 105 acres in the Desert Ridge area of North Phoenix for $266,000 an acre, a total sale of more than $28 million. The next day, Pima County bought more than 800 acres in southern Arizona for almost $2.5 million. That money goes to the trust beneficiaries, mainly public schools. State Land Commissioner Vanessa Hickman says the agency brought in $385 million during the last fiscal year.
We've seen a significant increase in land values in the past year. In the 2 years prior, we had achieved lower revenues for the trust than we had, obviously, in the years 2007, 2006. But we've had a lot of interest, and the appraisals that are coming back in on some of our key parcels that are in the inventory are at pre-recession pricing. So we're actively looking at property in Desert Ridge, where we still have large land holdings, and some of the other areas of the valley where we can justify selling land.
What's the overall plan? I mean, theoretically, the department eventually would get rid of all of the land, the 9+ million acres that it has. But you obviously don't want to do that right away or all in one fell swoop because you never know what the market's going to do. So how do you determine, okay, this is a good time to sell X acres of land here, X acres of land there, but let's hold on to some of the other stuff we have and maybe see what happens down the road?
We engage in very significant planning efforts at our department. A lot of analysis goes into determining whether or not to sell a piece of property. We are a market-driven agency, and so we also respond to applications. When we have somebody that comes into the department that is interested in a specific piece of property, we have discussions with our appraisers, with other people in our department that have expertise in real estate, and discuss whether or not it's the right time to roll out that piece of property or to wait for a future cycle.
Looking forward, I mean, do you anticipate to continuing to have fairly frequent auctions going forward, assuming that the economy stays reasonably where it is?
Yes. We'll continue to watch and see what the economy does. We've had some very positive indicators based on our recent auctions and the appraised land values that we're seeing. But if the land values start to decrease and we see that from a trust perspective, it's time to pull back, then we'll probably not sell as much land as we're looking at selling right now. But we do have a large number of applications on file. For now, we will likely see some more auctions coming up in the next year that achieve some very high returns for the trust.
Do you think the number of auctions and the return you get on the price per acre that you get from those auctions is an accurate indicator of where the general economy is, or at least the housing economy is, or the commercial development economy is in Arizona?
The minimum bid is set at appraised land value. So it is based on an appraisal. So the appraisal does have to look at comps, and they do have to appraise the land and ascertain what the value of that land is. So I do believe that that is a very good indicator of where the market is for the land. But these types of things can change quickly, as we all know.
State Land Commissioner Vanessa Hickman, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The average price for a gallon of unleaded regular gas in Arizona is $3.14 a gallon. Not terrible, or maybe we've just accepted the fact that the price is more likely to go up quickly and come down slowly. At least it seems that way. John Hoffmeister is founder and CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy and the former president of Shell Oil. He explains the price fluctuations.
In the industry, they talk about it in terms of up like a rocket, down like a feather. And it's a reality of how the market operates at the retail level. So here's an example. Take a corner gas station that needs a truckload of gasoline every day because they're well-liked by their neighborhood. They sell a truckload a day. When the price of crude is going up, it goes up unannounced. It's just the price rises based on market trading, OPEC's decision, et cetera. And so you could go from $80 a barrel to $85 a barrel, which has an immediate impact overnight on the price of gasoline, which has to be made from that crude oil. And so to get the next truckload of delivered gasoline, the retailer has to have enough money in the till to pay for the higher priced delivery the next day. So a smart retailer is going to raise the price as soon as he sniffs that the wholesale cost is going up, so he has the cash on hand to pay for the truckload of that gasoline delivery. The opposite happens when oil prices are in decline. So the station owner says, well, I think I'm going to have to pay less for the next truckload, but I'm not going to lower my price until I see others lowering their price. Maybe I can make a little money here while the price is dropping, and maybe volume will pick up while the price is dropping. But as soon as the near neighbor starts to drop their price, then you got to drop your price or you're going to lose business.
So what would it take to bring about change, to modify that situation?
We really have to look at competing alternatives for transportation fuel. A consumer who goes to a gas station and is thirsty has an incredible choice of what do they do to slake their thirst. You want coffee, you want water, you want juice, soda, even beer, wine, juices. You can have all the choice you want. You go to the gas pump, you can have gasoline as long as you want gasoline. That's it. One choice. Well, you have different blends, but it's all gasoline. And so Detroit has begun making flex fuel engines to accept alcohol fuel. Why don't we have government permission to increase alcohol fuel, either ethanol or methanol? Methanol made from natural gas. Natural gas from methanol would run about $1 a gallon wholesale. Why don't we have that available to us? Isn't this a free country? Don't we have free markets that ought to be able to deliver less expensive but competent, capable fuel? No, we don't, because we don't have government permission.
You've been a heavy hitter in this industry for a long time. So why don't elected officials, why don't politicians act on this?
Politicians tend to take priorities in political time, that is, between now and the next election. What's hot? What are the issues that have to be dealt with between now and the next election? And if gasoline prices are going up and they just keep going up, they'll deal with that. But they tend to reach a peak and then start coming back down. So they can push that issue off into the future. And so political time priorities trump energy issues all the time.
You're unhappy with the fact there isn't a broader energy policy. There hasn't been an energy plan for the U.S. Is there some sort of proposal you'd make some step you think needs to be taken?
The way we manage the monetary system is a good example. We have one central authority over the nation's monetary system, and all the banks, all the financial institutions, all the banking consumers, all the retail branches, it all works because we have this central authority that is not Congress and not the White House governing the financial monetary system. Mm-hmm. That's the Federal Reserve. Some people don't like it, but where would we be without it? I'd hate to think. I think we need an equivalent organization, an independent regulatory statutory authority that has the authority from Congress and the authority from the White House to manage our energy system and environmental system in terms of setting the big rules.
John Hoffmeister is founder and CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy. He's also former president of Shell Oil and a scholar at the Global Institute of Sustainability at ASU.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this week held a public hearing in northeastern Arizona on a proposal to expand the range of Mexican gray wolves. That followed a similar hearing in New Mexico last month. The wolf recovery program has been controversial, and this proposed rule change has been no exception. It would expand the wolves' boundaries as far north as I-40 and as far south as I-10. Eva Sargent is with the conservation group Defenders of Wildlife and is happy the feds decided to hold a meeting in Arizona.
Really important to have a hearing in Arizona. It's sort of a question of fairness. I mean, the only two states in the country that have Mexican wolves are Arizona and New Mexico, so it's really important for Arizonans to be heard on this issue.
Now, my understanding is that Defenders of Wildlife in general supports the proposed plan, but has at least one or two concerns with it. Is that right?
Actually, for Mexican wolves, it's sort of the other way. We mostly don't support the suggested changes. There's a couple of changes that are really necessary and good, but they're negated by other ones that we see as sort of a deal killer. And the biggest deal killer for us is that the proposal, although it would give the wolves more territory to roam in, it would still box them into just a larger area. And the problem with that is, in order to recover, Mexican wolves have to go to habitats that are north of I-40. And this box would prevent them from doing that. And we see that as a deal killer. It's as though the service is going to a lot of trouble to change the rules and yet ignoring science, ignoring what is actually needed for recovery.
Isn't having some reintroduction better than none?
Yeah, having some is better than none. But when you know what you have to do to get to real recovery, it's absurd to sort of waste that and to not try to get there. And the other important thing about wolves, you know, we don't want them to be a relic. We want them to be out there on the landscape doing what wolves do, which is making everything healthier.
Well, one of the concerns that some folks have is another thing that wolves do, which is kill livestock. And ranchers, as you know, have some concerns about sharing some of their grazing lands with wolves. So how do you balance helping the wolves sort of reach their habitat and doing some of the benefits that you've pointed out, while also making sure that the concerns of ranchers and some others are addressed?
Yeah, Defenders of Wildlife actually spends a lot of time working on that problem right there. You know, ranchers' concerns are legitimate. Wolves, in the large scheme of things, take very few livestock. But if they're your cows, that's a completely different story. That's an effect. And so we have a lot of programs working directly with ranchers to, we call it coexistence, to further coexistence. And some of these, they're just techniques that are proven to keep cows and wolves, you know, apart and disinterested in each other. But on the other hand, we need to balance the fact that these are public lands. You know, the current recovery area, 95% of the land is public land. So ranching needs to share with wolves and with other wildlife, and in general they do.
Eva Sargent is the Southwest Director of Defenders of Wildlife. Eva, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Another group that's closely following the proposed rule change is the Arizona Cattlemen's Association. Patrick Bray is its Executive Vice President.
We're deeply concerned about where the program is headed, and we think that it's time to start making that transition to state control. The population sits at 75 now. We have many wild-born pups. We have a goal kind of 100. We're concerned with where they're going as far as expansion.
It's interesting that you say that your group is concerned about expanding, and some of the conservation groups say the proposed changes wouldn't expand it far enough. How do you think you find a balance between that?
Well, I think really, in the rulemaking process that the Fish and Wildlife Service has put out, and you look at the area that they have proposed that they currently have, they have not biologically proven why they need to expand the wolf area beyond where it's at with a goal of 100. More importantly, where we should be focusing is in Mexico. We can do all the work in the world up here in that small area, but if we're not actively pursuing the 90% of their critical habitat, I think we're ultimately destined for failure.
How big of a concern is livestock and the animals that the wolves can kill?
When they released the first wolves in 1998, it is a known fact that they literally ate ranchers out of house and home. There were several ranchers that had to destock. They lost thousands of dollars. This day and age, they are still, you know, depredating on cattle. And when the market is as high as it is today, you're looking at $1,000 a head on calves. You're looking at anywhere from $1,200 to $1,500 on a mother cow. And so to replace those is quite expensive. And then the depredation accounts that they have are not adequately funded. You're talking maybe they give you $500-$600 on a calf, if you're lucky, you know, if you can prove the wolf kill, all of that.
Do you think there's room for some kind of agreement that will make ranchers happy, will make conservationists happy, will make everybody at least a little bit happy?
Absolutely. But this is the sad thing, I believe, about the wolf program, is that it's driven by politics, hidden agendas, and enviro litigators. And so let's put all of that aside. And we can come up with solutions that doesn't make everybody happy. I'm not sure. But it's something that we're able to stomach, go home with, make a living, and the people that want the wolves, you know, they can hear their howl of the wolf as well.
Patrick Bray with the Arizona Cattlemen's Association, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Brandon Imhoff, and I'm rock climbing. It's a good workout. There's vertical walls, there's walls with an overhang, and then each of them are going to have holds bolted into the walls that you hold onto with your hands and your feet in order to get from the bottom to the top. I really like the people. It's not like working out in a normal weightlifting gym. Everybody's really friendly. They all interact with each other. It's just a good atmosphere. The hardest part, I would say, would actually be the rock climbing itself. There's always harder routes that you can try. It kind of forces you to keep pushing yourself.
That's Brandon Imhoff rock climbing at Focus Rock Gym in Mesa. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a quick note, the show at kjzz.org.
Coming up, using art to do some practical good.
I saw some of the homeless getting ready for the night. So it was starting to get chilly out at night. I thought whatever I do needs to incorporate some kind of broader awareness.
Helping warm the homeless with an art project. That's ahead. It's the show.
Checking the early part of your afternoon commute on the freeways. Accidents, I-17 northbound at Cactus. That one's blocking the shoulder. Also a collision in the West Valley, I-10 westbound at Avondale Boulevard. And if you're on the 51 southbound, shoulders blocked by a collision at Greenway. Valley weather for tonight, partly cloudy skies with lows in the mid to upper 30s. For this weekend, it'll stay cool, and tomorrow there's even a slight chance for rain. Look for a high of 56. Currently sunny skies, 54 degrees in Phoenix.
KJZZ is supported by Whole Foods Market, offering support to local families in need with a fresh, wholesome meal during the holidays. Details about this program available at each register during checkout. Whole Foods Market, love local.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Child welfare advocates offered suggestions this week on ways to improve Arizona's Child Protective Services system in the wake of the agency disclosing that more than 6,000 cases have gone unreported. Linda Spears with the Child Welfare League of America says while she has seen instances elsewhere in which lots of cases don't get investigated, Arizona's number is very uncommon. She says child welfare systems tend to be pretty complex.
I think part of the challenge in making child welfare work is that there are a lot of moving parts that go into having a successful child welfare system, so that it is really very easy to have one of those parts get out of alignment. And when one of those parts gets out of alignment, you are at risk of having your system perform less than ideally. And if several of those parts get out of alignment, you're at risk of having the system perform very poorly.
So as Arizona looks to fix this and sort of get out from all of these uninvestigated cases and get its CPS program sort of on the right track, are there particular states that Arizona should be looking at as saying, this is a model for what we want to become?
Well, any given state has some things that has done well. I would say to you that a number of states have tried really hard on training of workers. So, for example, New Jersey is a good place where they've worked hard on training of workers over the years. Other states may have worked really very hard on building family support networks and family and community support networks, like Minnesota, Wisconsin have both done a reasonably good job of building family support systems in the communities for children. So I think you're going to have to look to several different jurisdictions in order to find all of the models for all of the pieces of the puzzle that will make a child welfare system work well. I doubt at any given time you're going to find one that has achieved everything it wanted to achieve in terms of that.
Well, based on your experience and what you've seen from different states and other jurisdictions around the country, are there a couple of things that you think officials here in Arizona should be doing right now to try to right the ship?
Yeah, the first thing they've got to do is get these kids seen. I mean, I think that that there's a real priority for that. And I think that they're going to have to, you know, pull out all the stops because you don't know how many of these kids are at risk. And that will require that they get the workforce shored up fast. I know that there's debate about whether or not more resources should be poured into an organization that's perceived to be performing poorly. But I can say this much, if resources aren't poured in, the problems will continue.
Linda Spears is the Vice President of Policy and Public Affairs with the Child Welfare League of America.
The draw for who plays whom in next year's World Cup has come to a close. Each time the event gets more glamorous and complicated. Basically, country names are drawn out of bowls, but no two European teams are allowed to be in the same group. The U.S. is in one of the so-called groups of doom, facing Germany, Ghana, and Portugal. Mexico has been placed with host Brazil, along with Cameroon and Croatia. BBC's Sport News correspondent Alex Capstick joins us now.
The draw began with a minute's applause for Nelson Mandela and a video tribute to him. And then we got on with the draw itself. Brazil, the host nation, and for many people, the favourites, will start off against Croatia. That'll be the opening match on June the 12th. Also in their group, Mexico and Cameroon. It's looking more difficult for the defending champions, Spain. They'll open against the team they beat in the final 3 years ago in South Africa, the Netherlands. Also in their group, another strong South American side, Chile. The outsiders, Australia. And whenever these draws take place, we always look for the toughest groups, the group of doom, I like to call them. I'll pick out two for you. Group G, Germany, considered one of the strongest sides in Europe, will open against Cristiano Ronaldo's Portugal. They've got Ghana as well, one of the strongest teams in Africa, and the USA. And Group D, that features Luis Suarez's Uruguay, England, who will open their campaign against Italy in Manaus in the jungle, the hottest of all the most humid of all the venues in the tournament.
That's the BBC's Alex Capstick.
State lawmakers from around the country have been in D.C. the past few days talking to members of Congress about several issues, including the Marketplace Fairness Act. The bill would give states the power to collect taxes on sales made online. The Senate has approved the measure, but it's been stuck in the House. We'll hear two perspectives on the bill from small business owners, starting with Lance Musley. He's the co-owner of Soul Sports Running Zone, which has three brick-and-mortar Valley locations.
We obviously, as a brick-and-mortar retailer, have a lot of competition from online stores, and we frankly have an online store of our own. But in Arizona, the average sales tax rate is about 8%. And when people shop online, the tax usually isn't collected, and therefore our online out-of-state competitors have essentially an 8% discount advantage, everything else being equal, compared to us.
How much of your business is done through your website?
Oh, it's between 5 and 10%. Fluctuates a lot, but it's a small portion of our overall business. But we always want to be, first and foremost, a brick-and-mortar, you know, local, community-based store.
Do you have a sense of how your business would benefit or how much more business you might be able to do if the Marketplace Fairness Act went into effect?
I would think at least a 10% increase, but boy, it really is hard to say.
One of the concerns that some online retailers have expressed is that just the confusion and the paperwork necessary when they're doing business in all different states and all different jurisdictions, that, you know, every town and city has its own taxes, counties sometimes have taxes, states have their own taxes. First of all, let me ask you, do you think that's a legitimate concern? And if so, do you think there's a way to sort of mitigate that, to streamline it so that retailers might not have to deal with all of the stuff that frankly you don't have to deal with being a brick and mortar store?
Yes, well, it is a legitimate concern, but when you peel it back a little bit further, I think it's not as big of a concern as opponents of this law want to make it seem. To me, it's analogous to shipping rates. Everything online, everything's getting shipped. And the rates from FedEx are extremely complex. But to the average person, we don't have to deal with the complexity. That's what software does for us. You input your food variables and out pops the rate and you're done. Same with sales tax. There are software solutions out there that take care of all that messy complexity for us. And that's why this is not the burden that it would have been, say, 15 years ago.
Lance Musley is the co-owner of Soul Sports Running Zone, which has three brick-and-mortar locations. Drax Davis is the CEO of Scrapbook.com, a Mesa-based company that sells craft supplies online. He's also the co-founder of the eMain Street Alliance, a group of small businesses that opposes the Marketplace Fairness Act.
In short, it puts a huge regulatory burden on them and stifles interstate commerce.
Do you think this is a small business, big business kind of thing? Because a lot of these big retailers already do a lot of the things that you're talking about. So is it the fact that you're a small business that you're worried about potentially precluding you from being able to do that?
Well, yes. I mean, there's been several studies done that show what the cost of compliance is for businesses of varying sizes and very large businesses. It's as a percentage of their owner overhead. Compliance is very small. Plus, they have armies of tax accountants in every state. But for the very small businesses, compliance requirements as a percentage of their overhead can be very significant.
Do you do sales in all 50 states?
Yes.
Do you think that by not having to collect sales taxes, I mean, does that give you an advantage, do you think, over, let's say, Mark's Scrapbooking Supply in Mesa that does have to collect sales tax?
Well, I do collect sales tax here in Mesa. So if there's a Mark's Scrapbooking Supply here in Mesa. So that's kind of a common misunderstanding. Just because somebody sells on the internet doesn't mean they don't collect. Our business has physical presence here. So we do collect and remit tax for every sale into the state of Arizona.
Do you have a sense of what the financial hit to your business would be if the Marketplace Fairness Act went into law?
Well, the integration cost of the software to our business that we got bids for was $80,000. That doesn't count labor costs for coding all of our products.
Do you think that you would lose sales to brick-and-mortar businesses?
You know, I really don't think we would lose sales to brick-and-mortar businesses. People don't shop online because of sales tax. People shop online because of convenience, because of selection. There's been a false divide created where people are thinking of the world in terms of, you know, physical brick-and-mortar and online retail. That line has been blurred for years now, and the number of businesses that are bricks and clicks is enormous and growing every day.
Drax Davis is CEO of Scrapbook.com and the co-founder of the eMain Street Alliance.
The impact of art on our souls and minds is indisputable. But how often is that effect practical? Artist Ann Morton answered a call from the City of Phoenix Arts and Culture Office looking for temporary projects to help enliven blighted spots along the light rail. Her ground cover, which went up today, involves hundreds of blankets coming together to form a work of art. When the so-called installation ends tomorrow, the blankets will be distributed to homeless groups. Morton explains the project.
I was doing some cross-stitch at the time, where you break down an image into pixels, basically, and stitch it, and thought, what if I just enlarged that idea? And also, I've been doing a lot of work with the homeless community here in Phoenix for the last several years. And so I combined that idea by making blankets. Each of the blankets has pixels in it that when they get put all together, it makes a giant image of desert flowers.
The first thing I thought of was the AIDS quilt, when that was such a big thing.
Yeah.
But those were, it didn't link together as a piece of art as yours does.
I drove around the streets of downtown, you know, because the project could be anywhere. It could have been on the side of a building or, I mean, anywhere, around a tree, anything. But I saw this one lot. It was nice and flat and open. And the actual meeting, there was a pre-submission meeting, and it was downtown. And when I left the meeting, I saw some of the homeless individuals getting ready for the night, kind of bedding down. And this was now a year ago. So it was starting to get chilly out at night. And I thought, you know, whatever I do needs to incorporate some kind of broader awareness of homelessness.
On your webpage, you wrote about how your art explores themes of social divides. And it made me think about how much homelessness divides us. What have you seen as someone, as you said, volunteering in that community in the last several years and now with your art involved in it?
We're all guilty of maybe avoiding a person that might look as though they live on the street. People don't engage with you. They don't acknowledge your presence. And so what I've really found amazing about this project is people all over the country that have gotten involved. There's 22 states plus Arizona involved. And I'm quite sure that we have ideology that is different from each other. We might have political views that are different or religious views that are different. But nobody asked any questions. Everybody just came forward to work on this project with this one idea in mind. Homelessness is a divide, but I feel like this is this kind of bridge that we can do for a short period of time. The problems are overwhelming, and this is a very small gesture, but hopefully it might be a gesture that means everything to one person.
Artist Ann Morton. If you want to see her brainchild ground cover, you can go to the northwest corner of First Street and McKinley. It'll be up until tomorrow.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Tomorrow is Pearl Harbor Day, and Arizona will dedicate its World War II memorial during a ceremony at Wesley Bowlen Plaza in Phoenix. Judy Beischel, state commander of the American Legion, is happy Arizona will now have a memorial honoring those who served during World War II.
I think it's way past due. I've been back several times to Arlington and to the memorials in Washington, D.C. I'm thrilled that they finally got that done, and now we have one in Arizona, so that hopefully an awful lot of our World War II veterans will get to see it, because we're losing them at about 300 a day.
Do you find that when there's an event like this, that it helps to sort of bring forth more education about the particular conflict? I mean, do you think people will start to ask more about World War II and ask for veterans about their stories in World War II just because this memorial is opening?
I think they will, and I hope that we have a lot of World War II veterans there tomorrow, but I'm glad that the other generations are also going to be able to hear this story and see the World War II memorial and maybe get better educated, because that's the big thing, is we need to get the children and our younger generation to understand the significance of these monuments. So,
You mentioned that it's past due for Arizona to have one of these. And you know, if you walk through Boland Plaza, there's memorials to a lot of different things. I mean, a lot of different wars, a lot of different other kinds of causes. Why do you think it is that up until now we haven't had a World War II memorial?
That's a very good question. It was kind of like they were, I call them our quiet heroes. You know, they came back and just put the war behind them and they went back to work. And I just think it's way, way past due that we honored them. I wish it had been much earlier so that more of them could have seen it.
Judy Beischel, State Commander of the American Legion, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
In the years following World War II, the base of South Mountain in Phoenix was filled with citrus and vegetable farms. Then a group of residents decided to grow something new. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us on a colorful journey along Baseline Road.
On Baseline Road and 38th Street, there is a flower shop filled with colorful arrangements. This is not any ordinary shop. It sits on the site of an original Japanese flower garden. It was a Phoenix attraction that caught the attention of tourists for decades. Did you know flowers like sweet peas, calendulas, and other annuals grown on Baseline Road supplied much of the country?
There was acres and acres of flowers here.
90-year-old Nick Nakagawa is one of the first Japanese Americans who had a flower farm here.
There's probably over 300 acres of flowers along Baseline at one time.
After World War II, Baseline Road between 48th and 32nd Streets was home to many Japanese Americans who leased land to farm citrus and vegetables until the 1950s, when these farmers discovered a better way to make money.
A neighbor was growing a few flowers that looked like a good product to grow, so we asked around and he encouraged me to grow flowers, so we started growing flowers and we started to supply the local florist.
Nakagawa says word about the farms spread quickly. It attracted tourists to the area, especially during the Arizona winter season. The farmers built small stands and tin kiosks to sell their flowers to the public. Holidays like Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, and Christmas were the busiest. At the same time, their wholesale business grew.
Some shippers from San Francisco heard about the flowers that we were growing, and they came down and bought them and shipped them to the eastern markets. We were selling about 80% of the flowers wholesale.
By the 1970s, many of these farmers made enough money to purchase the farms they had leased for so long. Nakagawa eventually owned more than 40 acres of farmland.
All of us grew about the same type of flowers, so there was enough business for everybody.
By the 1980s, business began to fade. The farmers couldn't compete with the booming flower industry in South America. Most farmers began selling their land to home developers. Nakagawa says he was among the last to sell out.
I guess we can call it progress. We all have to change with time.
And one last fact about growing flowers in this area. Japanese flower growers praise the microclimate at the foot of South Mountain. The mountain creates a downdraft that keeps the warm air on the ground to protect the valuable crop. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
We're always looking for ideas. We hope not to run out anytime soon. So if you have one, send it to us at the show at kjzz.org.
Archaeologists in China are to begin removing treasures from the wreck of an ancient merchant ship thought to be the most important marine discovery the country has ever made. The ship was raised from the seabed 6 years ago and has been kept in a steel container full of salt water ever since. The BBC's China correspondent Damian Grammaticus has more.
It was 800 years ago when the Nanhai One, laden with Chinese porcelain, precious metals and coins, sank, probably in a storm in the South China Sea. A team of British marine treasure hunters discovered the wreck in the 1980s. They were looking for a different vessel and stumbled upon the 13th century ship by chance. Pieces of blue and white Song Dynasty porcelain, silver bars and a gold belt, probably belonging to a crew member, were recovered, hinting at riches that lay inside the Nanhai One. But it wasn't until 6 years ago that a Chinese team finally raised the 100-foot-long merchant vessel from the seabed. They had to build a giant metal box around the ship and lift it, still covered by silt and seawater, to preserve the wooden hull. glass windows in the side of the container will mean visitors can watch the diving teams, who will now begin digging out the artifacts still inside the Nanhai One. It's thought there could be up to 80,000 pieces of porcelain and other treasures yet to be recovered.
The BBC's Damian Grammaticus.
It'll be a chilly weekend, but that does not mean you should hide in your house. There is plenty to do, including Bally Arizona beginning its annual run of the Nutcracker tonight at Symphony Hall.
Steve, I know you'll be at Beyonce's concert on Saturday night at U.S. Airways Center.
Yeah, and Mark, and then you'll be at the Andrea Bocelli concert.
Of course.
Let's just do tit for tat.
Okay, absolutely. The APS Electric Light Parade is Saturday. I get you into the holiday spirit. If you're Steve, you'll think it's right cold enough to be in the holiday spirit.
And Alice Cooper's Christmas Pudding, the annual show. This features the four current members of KISS and Mark's favorite lead singer, Vince Neil of Motley Crue.
Yes. The Suns host the Toronto Raptors tonight at U.S. Airways Center. ASU and Stanford play for the Pac-12 championship tomorrow at Sun Devil Stadium. And the Cardinals host division rival the St. Louis Rams Sunday afternoon at the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale.
The show is produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez. With help from Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team, our managing editor, Al Macias, and our news director is Peter O'Dowd. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Phoenix, developing customized lung cancer treatment programs through minimally invasive procedures to improve quality of life. CancerCenter.com.